Earnhardt Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And guess what we're going to be talking about today? That's right, food, my favorite subject. And there are so many things, of course, that are connected to our food choices, health, environment, animals. We have a very, very super special guest today who's going to really, I think, bring it all into focus and give us some great inspiration to move forward. Ocean Robbins is my guest, and in 1990, at age 16, he was the co-founder of YES, Youth for Environmental Sanity, which he directed for 20 years. He's the co-host and CEO of the 75,000-member Food Revolution Network, which we will be talking about in a moment. Ocean has spoken in person to more than 200,000 people and facilitated more than 50 week-long gatherings for leaders from more than 65 nations. He serves as an adjunct professor in the Peace Studies Department at Chapman University. He's the author of Choices for Our Future and The Power of Partnership, and has served as a board member for Friends of the Earth, Earth Save International, and many other organizations. He's a founding member of the Turning Tide Coalition, co-founder of the Leveraging Privilege for Social Change program, and founding co-convener of Leverage Alliance. And he is the recipient of the Freedom's Flame Award, the National Jefferson Award for Outstanding Public Service by an Individual 35 years or younger, and the Harmon Wilkinson Award for Outstanding Contribution to the Social Sciences. Wow. Thank you for joining me, Ocean. You are one amazing individual.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Your story is pretty incredible, and I just want people to understand how it all began, because to me, I think it's a part, obviously, of what made you, but most people cannot grasp your beginnings in a simple log cabin.
Well, I'll even go back another generation to give you a little context. My grandfather founded Baskin-Robbins Ice Cream Company, 31 flavors, and my dad, John Robbins, was groomed to one day join in the family company. He grew up with an ice cream cone-shaped swimming pool in the backyard and 31 flavors of ice cream in the freezer at all times. But he felt called in a different direction, and he ended up walking away from any access to the family wealth and from the chance to join in the family company to follow his own rocky road. So he moved with my mom to a little island off the coast of Canada, where they built a one-room log cabin, grew most of their own food, and lived on less than $500 a year, which was kind of a pendulum swing from a class perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I was born in the middle of the woods to parents that were doing yoga and meditating for several hours a day and living very simply and calling their son Ocean. That's me. And I grew up kind of far away from a lot of the world's problems. I had clean air and clean water and beautiful forests and time with my parents. But I grew up feeling rich because even though I was monetarily poor. And that's because of all the love in my family. And then when I got a little older, we moved to California. And my dad began work on a best-selling book called Diet for a New America. It came out in 1987, and it inspired millions of people to look at their food choices. Yeah, to look at food as a chance to not just look at our own health, but actually impact the world around us. And so I wanted to reach out and mobilize my generation around this important issue. When I was 16, I founded Youth for Environmental Sanity, or YES, to help mobilize a new generation of young environmental leaders with food as a central part of our environmental message. And then over the years, that has evolved. And today I'm the CEO of the Food Revolution Network, which I direct with my dad. And our food focus is on healthy, sustainable, humane, and delicious food for everybody.
You know, I'm very glad that you took the path that you did, because we need you. We need a million of you. And your father chose to walk away from what his father had to offer. And fortunately, you are pretty much in line with what your dad offered for you in terms of philosophy and ethics.
Well, in many ways, that's true. And if people ask me, you know, do you feel like you're standing in your dad's shadow, I say, you know what, actually, I feel like I'm standing in his light. Because my dad really has blazed a trail, not just a trail of a certain way of eating or even a certain way of thinking, but a trail of integrity. You know, he chose the path that most people wouldn't take in the modern world, which is that he walked away from a life of sure financial riches because his integrity called him in a different direction, and he felt like inventing a 30-second flavor wasn't why he was put on this earth. He wanted to contribute to building a more ethical, compassionate, healthy, beautiful world. And so that is the model that I follow more than any particular philosophy. And I think he's always been in search of the truth more than any particular ideology. He wants to know, you know, how do we really be healthy? How do we really thrive? How do we create a more beautiful world? And, you know, we let the facts dictate our philosophies, and the world is constantly evolving, and we're always learning new things. But the core purpose to contribute in some meaningful way to making a more beautiful and vibrant world has guided his life almost from the beginning, and I'm so grateful that I'm able to build on that legacy and carry it forth, you know, in my life.
Yeah, well, you're definitely doing that, and you started very, very young. I mean, even before you founded YES, you were quite active and an activist in your school and really ahead of your time.
It's true. I led my first peace rally when I was 8 years old. Yeah, and you know what's funny, Karin, is that I feel like from my early childhood I had people telling me I was going to save the world someday, and that creates its own kind of challenge.
Yeah.
Because I had this sense of pressure inwardly that I should accomplish huge things and be huge things, and then there's a kind of perfectionism that can come with that. So, you know, the greatest teacher to me in this journey more recently has been my own children. Because, you know, my dad used to tell me when I was growing up that he was proud of all my accomplishments.
Right.
But he'd love me just as much if I was autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that was really sweet, and I also didn't have to put his theory to the test because I wasn't autistic.
Mm-hmm.
But now I have twins, they're 12 years old, and they do have autism.
Yeah.
And so we're learning about unconditional love. We're learning about what it means to love somebody just because everybody deserves love, and not for necessarily all the things that anybody accomplishes and does. And that's changing the way I feel about myself in really profound ways, because I'm learning if I can love my kids just as they are, then maybe I can love me just as I am.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I'm realizing that everybody's kids, whether they're precocious and brilliant peace rally organizers or, you know, they're struggling to make it through the day, deserves love. And so the work that I do has taken on a whole new meaning, actually, because it's not just about the elite few, it's about everybody.
Well, we love you, as you are, with all the wonderful things you've done, and even if you didn't do any more wonderful things, you're a wonderful person.
Thank you.
But I can imagine that is a little bit of a burden to carry, thinking that you should save the world. And there are a number of people that are inflicted with some of that or a piece of that. And I guess it's all a part of growing up. We have to live with integrity, do what we believe in, and leave the rest behind, because we can't, as individuals, affect 7 billion people.
Right, or we can in some way, but we certainly can't manage them and control them.
Right.
You know, and I think ultimately, you know, all of us have just got to do the best we can with what we've got.
That's right.
And that's all that any of us can ever be expected to do, is the best we can with what we've got. And no matter what we've got, there's always the best we can do. And, you know, if happiness is a product of some combination of what happens to us and the choices we make, then I always say, you know, most of us spend most of our time bitching and complaining and groaning and grumbling about all the things that happen to us, and that actually robs us of our capacity to do the best we can with where we actually have power, which is in the choices we make and how we respond to life.
You hit it on the head. That's mostly everyone's issue or problem today. They're complaining. They don't realize what their potential is or what they have. Okay, so one of the things, you know, you talked about feeling like you were rich when you were young, where you really didn't have any financial assets or means. And yet today, most kids, at least in the United States, grow up with so much stuff, even if they're middle class or even considered poor. I mean, I've seen some people that are considered not very well to do, and they still have a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I know that that's affected you profoundly to live in that richness. And what saddens me today is how many people are void of that, empty. And we need everyone to make a difference. We need everyone to be acting to make this world a better place and to work with integrity. But so many people are really living in this superficial place of collecting more stuff that really isn't filling them up at all.
Sure, and we see that with food too. I mean, a lot of times we feel this kind of emptiness in our souls, and often we try to fill it with more stuff, more things, more food, more short-term pleasure, and we are missing out on what may be the real sources of happiness and health, which are more nourishing. And a lot of times in the food world, for example, I mean, you can choose foods that will provide short-term high-level stimulation and high-level caloric intake, like highly salted, highly sugared, highly fatty foods. And we can actually train our taste buds to think that those are delicious, and
mm-hmm.
most of us have,
mm-hmm.
because that's what's so heavily marketed. And it does provide a kind of short-term pleasure. But I believe that long-term, you have way more pleasure in your life when you nourish your body with healthy, natural, wholesome foods that really support you and affirm you. It's like, I don't want to just have friends that are always sugary and sweet and nice to me and never tell me the truth. And I don't want to have foods that are always sugary and sweet and nice to me and don't give me real nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So when we can adjust our lives and our taste buds to actually be drawn to people or to foods that are really good for us, then we're going to find much more quality of life. And suddenly our taste buds will change. When you choose to root your life around healthy, natural foods, you're actually not drawn to stuff that might have tasted good before earlier in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was raised in a family where we ate a lot of kale and broccoli and, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables. And so I thought that was tasty. And, you know, raising my own kids growing up, you know, that's one thing I'm really grateful for. They love healthy food. And mm-hmm. literally one day, River, our son, was crying because, you know, we'd run out of broccoli in the house. So I don't think that's too common in American households today. But really, we are very much a product of our conditioning and our habits.
You know,
they become normal, and it becomes easier and easier to do the right thing.
I do want to get to the Food Revolution Network, but you mentioned your children, and I do know that a lot of people who have autistic children really have challenges with food and how the kids really don't want to eat healthfully. So how did you manage to have success in that area?
Well, here's the key with kids and food is that you just have to not buy the stuff you don't want them eating. If they're not exposed to it, then it's going to reduce the issue tremendously. If you have your cupboards that include, you know, potato chips and French fries and junk food, whatever that might be, and lots of cookies, then you're always going to be fighting to keep them away from it. So you just have to, especially with autistic kids, just not expose them to that stuff, which sometimes might even mean that you can't take them shopping if you're having a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
Don't put them in front of the stuff. Autistic kids are very impulsive. So they tend to be drawn to what's in front of them, and they're not usually going to form heavy-duty attachments to foods they've never tasted in their lives before. You know, it's similar with television. If you want a kid to not watch TV, the best and easiest solution for everybody is to not have a TV. You know, then
mm-hmm.
you're really not going to have much issue unless they're at a friend's house, and it's still greatly mitigated. So I think the bottom line is take responsibility for what you put on the shopping list and what they're exposed to, and the less mature somebody is, whether developmentally or, you know, for other reasons, the more important it is that a parent exercise that responsibility. Don't take them into McDonald's if you don't want them to eat the food that McDonald's serves.
You know, it sounds pretty straightforward, and I think it applies to all children and all adults, not just to autistic children. Okay, let's go to the Food Revolution Network. What is it?
Okay. The Food Revolution Network is an online education and advocacy program that's working for healthy, sustainable, humane, and delicious food for everybody. We have about 90,000 members. People can sign up at foodrevolution.org to join our network and become a part of this community and gain access to our free Food Revolutionary Action Guide and ongoing resources and tools to help you be a food revolutionary. We also sponsor the Food Revolution Summit, which mobilizes people worldwide through bringing out the voices of some of the world's top food revolutionary leaders. My dad, John Robbins, and I are personally interviewing 24 incredible leaders who are really transforming the lives of millions, and we're bringing forth their insights and exploring, you know, what do they have to bring now in this day and age that will really help us to learn from the latest learnings of medical science, the latest learnings of the sustainability movement, and the transforming dynamics of our food systems. How can you protect your family from big agribusiness? How can you protect your community? How can you contribute meaningfully to not just the personal choices we want to make, but the systemic ones? How can we make it so that it stops being so much cheaper to buy Snickers than to buy spinach? How can we make it so that healthy food is an option for a lot of people who right now, frankly, can't afford the kind of yuppie lifestyle and are just struggling to survive? We need to change food policy. We're paying a terrible price for the current system. Two-thirds of disease in the U.S. today is chronic disease that could be prevented with a change in diet. We're spending, you know, 18-19% of our U.S. GDP on health care costs, and frankly, that shouldn't be called health care. It should be called disease care.
Yeah.
And if we change our diet collectively, we can save so much money, we can save so much misery, and we can help create a brighter future for future generations. So we're sharing those stories and those insights, and the Food Revolution Summit is available also from foodrevolution.org, or go directly there at foodrevolution.org/summit to join us and find out all about how you can get involved in this vital movement.
So when is the next summit?
April 27 to May 5.
And can you give us an idea of who's going to be participating?
Absolutely. Well, some of the people, we're expecting over 50,000 people to be participating in the summit. And we're going to be interviewing some really fabulous people, including Dr. Dean Ornish, Vandana Shiva, Griff Esselstyn, Reverend Michael Beckwith, Dr. Neil Barnard, Ken Cook from the Environmental Working Group. Also looking at food and consciousness with speakers like Byron Katie and Kathy Freston. We have Mark Hyman. We have Mayor Cory Booker, the superstar mayor from Newark, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We have Mike Adams from naturalnews.com and Mark Bittman, the writer for the New York Times.
Wow.
And Dr. Joel Furman and Jeffrey Smith and Andy Kimbrell talking about GMOs and why you should be concerned about the fact that three-quarters of the items in your typical supermarket or restaurant contain genetically modified organisms. We'll be looking at food and compassion with Zoe Weil, founder of the Institute for Humane Education. So quite a collection of folks. That's only the tip of the iceberg, to be honest. And I'm so excited to bring forth these voices. And my dad knows how to interview people like nobody else because this has been his life and work for more than 25 years. So this is more than your typical kind of call and response interview. This is really a game-changing conversation.
Sounds pretty good. Now, you had your first summit last year. Are there any things that stood out or things that you learned from that event last year?
Well, what stood out to me was a lot of hope, actually. I mean, Dr. Martin Luther King said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And sometimes I think it bends so slowly that some of us can get really impatient and start to wonder whether it's even bending in the right direction at all. But when you look at the arc of history, you can see certain things. I mean, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony dedicated their lives to working for women's right to vote, you know, many, many, many decades, and they died without ever seeing it come to pass. And it didn't come to pass for 30 years after they died.
Mm.
But eventually women did get the right to vote. And you know what? It took an all-male legislature in every state in the country to be able to get that passed. So the arc of history not only had to change the general population, it actually had to reach all of the men in the country in order to make that happen. And, you know, we also saw, in not too many years ago that African Americans couldn't vote in the United States, in many states. And so we're seeing these changes, and I think that compassion and an ethic of compassion towards all beings is another thing that's evolving right now. We're seeing more and more Americans you know, whether we eat meat or not, not liking the way that animals are being treated in factory farms, and standing up and calling for a new way of, a more humane way of humanity relating to other species. And we're seeing that the impact of industrialized agribusiness is sending out ripples all over the planet. It's impacting farmers in India. It's impacting the tropical rainforests. It's impacting our carbon output and our climate. And, of course, it's impacting our health. And so the beautiful thing that I really saw as we move forward to last year's summit is that these things all fit together, and that the same food choices that are healthy for us personally are also a beautiful expression politically. If we want a healthy world for future generations, if we want a more compassionate world, if we want to be healthy and to help our families be healthy, you know, all of these impulses eventually point us more or less in the same direction.
Isn't that amazing?
I think that's a fabulous thing to realize.
Absolutely. It's like the same diet will cure most diseases or prevent them, and are the gentlest on the environment and certainly the most compassionate to all living things. It's a win-win-win.
It's true. And, you know, the other thing that I was really struck by in our last summit is that this is an opportunity that's available to everybody. You know, you don't have to be an expert to make changes and to take advantage of what the experts have discovered. And, you know, although we have so many fad diets going around and so much controversy about what people should eat, you know, there are certain things that are fairly indisputably obvious. You know, eating a lot of sugar and highly processed foods and saturated, you know, hydrogenated fat is clearly bad for us. Eating a lot of factory-farmed animal products and basing our diets around that is clearly bad for us. And so we're learning. You know, basing your diet around whole, simple, natural foods, locally grown as much as possible, organically grown if possible, plant strong if possible, these are basic things that will radically change your life. So we call our summit the Food Revolution Summit because I actually think it's kind of revolutionary in a context where the norm is making us so sick and is so destructive to our environment and to our ethics as human beings. I think that it is a revolutionary act to stand up for something different. And it just so happens that doing so can also be delicious and fun and add more pleasure and joy to our lives. So the nice thing about this revolution is you don't have to go to war for it. You can actually celebrate it every step of the way.
Well, it is a revolution, but when we look at history, the history of food, there's a lot of things that have happened, especially in the last 50 years, that have really turned things around and made things really out of control environmentally and health-wise. And it's amazing how it all just kind of snuck up on us and changed everything. But now we need a revolution to take it back and do what's best for people on the planet.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, we've certainly seen, you know, the introduction of genetically engineered, mass-produced pseudo-foods and food-like substances on a massive scale. And, you know, we're paying a terrible price. Rates of diabetes are out of control. Rates of obesity are completely out of control. And, you know, they're bankrupting governments and companies and families and school systems, and you know, we need massive change. And the number of kids that are hyperactive or autistic or have some form of severe disability is skyrocketing. The number of food allergies is skyrocketing, and you know, this is all connected. We are exposing our bodies and our families to levels of toxins and chemicals that are completely unprecedented in human history. And a few companies are making a whole lot of money by marketing this stuff to us. But our lands and our family farmers and our own health are paying a terrible price for it. And what I think is exciting is that we're seeing a radical change unfolding. Organic foods have, you know, increased fourfold in the last decade. And interest in natural foods is skyrocketing. And so I think that, you know, there's like an immune system in a time of illness. And people are responding.
You made an important point before, which I have to continually remind myself to do, and that is to look at the past and see how far we've come in such a short time. Because when I look at the short-term situation, it's really easy to be frustrated and think, what's the point of doing anything at all? So I appreciate you bringing that up when the women got the right to vote and when we had civil rights acts, and all of those things are amazing. You have worked with young people, with Youth for Environmental Sanity, all over the world. And Have you found something that connected the dots for all of them? You know, we have come from different cultures and different religions and different beliefs, but I want to believe that we really have a lot of things that are the same.
Well, I think we do. I mean, the beauty of it is that we are all unique, that actually each one of us is the only one of us on this entire planet. And I think that's a wonderful thing, personally. At the same time, we have a lot in common, and my own experience is that two of the single most unifying forces on the earth are tears and smiles. And, you know, no matter what language you speak and what culture you come from, you know, when you, when you're with somebody and they shed a tear, you're touched. You know, when the best way to make someone cry watching a movie, any filmmaker will know, is to have people crying on the screen and to have the audience feeling emotionally identified with them. And at the same time, laughter is an incredible unifying force. And when we laugh, it sends a signal through our body of comfort and peace and joy and connection. And so I really look at the fact that our sadness is a bonding force, and we all have a lot to be sad about, and our joy is a bonding force, and we all have a lot to be happy about. So I think we need more celebration as well as more mourning with people that we love and care about. And I think that love is a unifying force. You know, when you feel love, you feel more open, more happy, more connected. And so I'm really interested in how we can live love and live joy more fully in this world. And I think that as we do so, we become more happy, we actually become more healthy, and we certainly become more connected and feel less lonesome.
Love heals everything.
It does. And that's not just some hippie talk, by the way. Gratitude also heals a lot. There have been some recent studies that have come out that have shown conclusively that the more we express our gratitude, the more healthy we're going to be. You know, people literally have longer marriages, better health outcomes, more happiness, less need for antidepressants, and are just generally better off in just about every measure we can find if they just take 5 minutes a day to write down things they're grateful for. And this has been proven out in a number of studies. It's quite conclusive. So, you know, one of the top tips, if you want to have more joy in your life and feel more fulfilled, is to think about what you're grateful for and spend time every day focusing there.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to end this program, Ocean, and say that I am so grateful for you.
Well, thank you. And I hope listeners will join us at foodrevolution.org and join us. And we have much to be grateful for. Please join this food revolution and find your own part in working for healthy food, sustainable food, delicious food. Food that will nourish our bodies and our spirits and our world.
Okay, we're looking forward to it. Foodrevolution.org, and if you want to learn more about Ocean, oceanrobbins.com. Thank you again. And I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and we're going to take a quick break and be right back. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are in April 2nd, 2013. Okay, next up, I'm going to bring on Sid Garza-Hillman. He has a lovely little book, Approaching the Natural, a Health Manifesto. We're going to be talking a bit about that today. Sid was born in Los Angeles. He graduated from UCLA with a BA in philosophy. For over a decade after college, he was a working musician and actor with a growing interest in nutrition. Sid is now a certified nutritionist and weight management coach. He works with private clients all over the country and teaches nutrition and healthy living classes to children and adults through his practice Transitioning to Health. He is also the staff nutritionist and programs director at the Mendocino Center for Living Well, located at the Stanford Inn Echo Resort in Mendocino, California. He currently lives on the Mendocino coast with his wife, three children, two dogs, and two guinea pigs, White Rose and Pink Rose. Well, there you have it. Welcome to It's All About Food, Sid.
Thanks. It's funny to hear that bio read back to me. Yes, the guinea pigs, that's the pivotal point of the bio.
Is it really? Why is that?
I just think it's my daughter named them White Rose
White
and Pink Rose.
Pink Rose, yeah. They're very nice names. Well, Sid, I've never met you in person, and I feel like we may be kindred spirits after reading your manifesto. I'm speechless. I'm just saying, yes, right. I would have written it exactly that way. Anyway,
wow, thank you.
So I really appreciate where you're coming from.
Oh, thank you. That's great to hear.
You know, we don't like to feel alone in this world, and it's nice to know that we agree with people or people agree with us from time to time.
That's right, and we're both singers, so that's a good thing.
That might be a part of it, but we'll get to the music. I'm going to save the best for last.
Right.
Okay, sounds like you have a pretty good life. You know, I have never been in Mendocino, and I'm going to get there now.
You got to come up. It's an amazing place to live, and after 20 years in Los Angeles, it was a really welcomed change.
And is it? You know, I have visions of Mendocino, this little town that time forgot or something like that, but what is it really like today in 2013?
I mean, it really is kind of like that. It's kind of amazing. The entire county of Mendocino has less than 90,000 people in the entire county.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is one of the last bastions of sort of small-town living, and, you know, the little things when I moved up here made me the happiest, like that there are no parking meters, you know, like stuff that people would go, yeah, what about the trees? And I'm like, yeah, but there's no parking meters, you know, and there's one stoplight in the town of Mendocino, you know, and it's really a legitimate small town, and it has the aesthetic of this beautiful little coastal place, and the people are really friendly, and it's very natural. So
okay,
it's a
let's
great
not advertise it anymore because we don't
know,
want everybody
right?
running there.
I know, right?
All right. So, in a brief nutshell, when did you get so smart about food and nutrition and health?
Well, it began, in a nutshell, it began in 1992. I had just graduated from UCLA the year before, and I was a struggling musician. I hadn't yet fallen into acting yet, so I was actually working at UCLA in the audiovisual department, but I was a chronic asthmatic and was handed a book by actually by Woody Harrelson, who I worked for in college as a personal assistant. And he and his wife, Laura Louie, who's a close friend of mine and my sister's, but they handed me a book, and I read it, and I removed dairy. And that's the only thing I did at the time, and my asthma went away.
Mm-hmm.
And that began my trek of reading, you know, literally book after book. I've been reading constantly for over 20 years on the subject. And that's how it began. And finally, when I moved up here, I thought, this is really, I want to do this for a living. And so I went back to school and became a certified nutritionist.
Now, you also studied philosophy. And
right.
I think there's a connection. And I don't know that all philosophers get to where I think they should go. But, I mean, I appreciate some of the books that have been written from a philosophical standpoint where they ultimately realize we shouldn't be eating animals.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, I couldn't. I had to address that in the context of a broader approach to health, and an approach that is at the. I guess, you know, if you had to sort of make an overarching statement, the approach is that when we work in line with our natural design, we thrive, and when we work in conflict with our natural design, we don't. And when it comes to, you know, our treatment of animals and the way that we harvest them and the imbalance, the natural imbalance we've created in large part because of the animal culture, but also because of the refining and processing of food and the environmental toll that takes, that's working in conflict, I believe, and argue, with our species as a whole. And you can see the effects of that on the world and on the way that we treat ourselves. I think there's a direct relationship there. So, yeah,
yeah.
I took the big questions there.
Okay. Now, you train and you call, I'm at a loss for words all of a sudden. You consult with people about nutrition, and you've come up with a plan, and you go through it in this lovely book, Approaching the Natural, a Health Manifesto. And what I like about it is you can almost slip it in your back pocket, but it's loaded with a lot of information. Your technique is telling people, take whatever steps, take the time you need, small bites, small changes. You don't need to jump into a big a big transition in big steps.
Yeah, I mean, that is, in a nutshell, you nailed it. And the reason is because when I began practicing, that's what people, they're sort of drawn to that kind of thing. And that's why most diet books are, you know, hugely popular for a time. You know, the 7-day this and the 21-day this. And it's not like they're bad plans at all. It's just that people don't stick to them. They don't stick to diets. We know that they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we still are drawn. We go, okay, well, that one didn't work. I didn't stick to that long term. But how about this one? And I decided, you know what, I'm going to write a book. And it is a hip pocket. I mean, it does fit in your back pocket. It's the publisher specifically sized it to be that kind of thing where you could, as a reminder to say, hey, you know what, it doesn't sound like it's going to do anything, but it really does for you to do really the littlest step that you can do that will actually make you do something every day for the rest of your life and create a foundation from which you can build. But when we constantly do this, you know, juice fast for 10 days and everyone goes, oh my God, you look fantastic and you lose all this weight and then you go back and you don't make the change and then you feel worse about yourself because you just gained all the weight back and it's just this never-ending cycle. And we do that with exercise. We join a gym and we get all the equipment, you take all the classes, that's it, I'm going to exercise an hour and a half every day. But most of us don't have the time. And when you just establish a good behavioral pattern, a new living healthy pattern, even if it's walking around your house one time a day, that's a good start. That's the argument I make, because we know the other way doesn't work.
Well, I know that most people say they don't have the time, and I want to say I don't believe it. I want to say turn off the television.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing. But you know what? I got to say, like, my wife and I have an 8.5-year-old. We've got 4-year-old twins. My wife's a graphic designer. She works full-time. I work full-time. We don't watch TV. Like, we're busy. We work at night because we don't really have childcare at all. And so we are super busy. So for me, and I address this in the book, like, the only thing that I'm a runner. I love running. That's my love. But we just didn't have time. We do now. We're just starting now. But the first couple years of the babies, it was
it's tough.
Brutal.
Small children.
And the only thing I could do was I bought a mini tramp. And I would just do that in the living room because I could still watch the kids and my wife could get work done and then she would get on the tramp. And that's what we could manage. And so you can find the time. I mean, anybody can do squats in their living room and hold two big books in their hands as weights. I mean, you can do that. And that's what I argue. Those are profound acts. That's the difference. I think those are huge.
Yeah. Even taking a 10-minute break from whatever it is you're doing, sitting at the computer or being in an office and doing something physical, you are much more productive.
Oh, yeah, huge. And I think, and again, it's like we understand that, but I think people are like, that's not going to do anything. And I just try to argue in the book, whether I'm effective at it or not, I don't know, but I make the argument in the book that that's where it's at. Like, those little 10-minute shots, like, they will infuse such an energy into your life that it's astounding. And you can go, oh, my God, like, I just turned off my phone for 1 minute and talked to somebody over a cup of coffee, and that really made a difference in the rest of my day, you know?
Turn off the television.
Yes, and I'm totally guilty of that same thing. You know, thank God I have a good marriage because my wife's like, you get off that thing. You know, like, it's good to have somebody in your life who's like, get recalibrate for a second, you know.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I run, I do some yoga, a bunch of different things, and I learned yoga from tapes, actually, not from going to classes. I've never been really good sitting in a class. But I hear this one line Patricia Walden says on one of my yoga tapes. I think it was Patricia Walden. Anyway, it's the consistency of your practice. It's the consistency of your practice. No matter what it is, consistency. 5 minutes every day, 10 minutes every day, whatever it is, consistency will get you somewhere.
100%. And that's just where I'm at. And I just think if you break it down into literally what is manageable for you, if all that is manageable for you right now, because all you do is fast food every day, and that's just where you're at, but you want to change your health, and all you can manage is a piece of celery per day, and that will start, you can do that every day, I think that's an incredible thing to do. Most people would argue, oh, no, that's not going to do anything, and I think it will, because if you can eat celery every day, one stalk of celery, you become a person who eats well. Maybe not well enough to become super healthy, but that's later. You establish the baseline behavior pattern, and then you can build later to two stalks of celery or eating a salad with your Big Mac and then onwards and upwards. But you start thinking about things. You start paying attention to what you put in your body and how you feel, and that's where it begins. That's lifelong change.
Let's talk about celery a little bit here. I'm glad you brought celery up. Celery,
Let's
that food that really doesn't get the press that it deserves, but then most plant foods don't. Celery is loaded with electrolytes, minerals.
It's a hugely. You know what's funny about celery is what everybody who talks about celery, what do they say? They go, that's a waste. You burn off the same amount of calories you get from when you eat it. First of all, that's not even true anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has been debunked. But secondly, that just shows our focus on macronutrients and calories. And what I tell people that when I teach, I say, you in America, you don't have a shortage of calories, and you've probably never met anybody who has a shortage of calories. We're not a starving nation, but what we are is a malnutrient nation, and what we're lacking are the vitamins and minerals and antioxidants and phytochemicals. Celery is full of those things. If you're worried about calories, yeah, okay, celery is not calorically dense, but it's full of a whole bunch of awesome stuff that we need.
Yeah, well, most people don't know anything about nutrition, and then they spout out stuff that they've heard in a soundbite somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's killing us.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I always tell people in my classes, is like, if taking a vitamin pill and eating really bad food was working, I wouldn't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's the proof's in the pudding. We're not getting healthier as a nation, no matter what people say.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I love celery, and I make a green juice every day, and I usually have 5 or 6 stalks of celery in my juice.
Yeah, I eat like 5 stalks of celery every day.
Yeah, and then
the car,
I tell people, you know? If you want to lose weight, you know, just eat 5 or 6 stalks of celery and a pound of greens, and then you can have whatever you want.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's the message. Add in the good stuff, you'll be fine. And then you start thinking about it more, and you start realizing how the other food doesn't make you feel good, and it makes the decision easier.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, most people can eat a pound of greens and 6 stalks of celery. They're stuffed.
Right. I know. Stuffed with very little calorie, right? But
right.
Still a whole bunch of good stuff,
right.
You know, a whole bunch of amazing stuff that we're lacking. So.
All right. You talk about running with these, what do they call those things, barefoot or with these special barefoot-like.
Yeah, well, the ones I run in, I run in 2 different ones. I run in the Vibram 5 Fingers, and then I've become friends with Rich Roll, who's a ultra athlete.
Yeah, I've
he recommended
him on this show.
He's awesome.
Extremely
and,
crazy.
Huh?
Crazy.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about him today when I was running. I don't know how he has how he has managed the physical feats that he has done.
Oh yeah, yeah, he's an amazing guy, and it was a pleasure reading his book, and I'm really happy to have befriended him. But he recommended another pair of New Balance that are minimal shoes too. And my only argument is that, like everything else, you know, we have a pretty incredible design, a natural design, and if we, being our personalities, get out of the way and allow our bodies to do what they're meant to do and designed to do, we usually do pretty darn well. And that means, you know, the whole hugely padded, raised heel shoe model hasn't worked for us, and we're getting injured. And so that's why there's a big movement to go back to a more minimal footwear and appeal to the natural design of the foot. And that's just
now,
the only argument
for
me.
This isn't like a marketing thing to get us to buy more stuff?
You know, I don't think it is, because first of all, those shoes are way cheaper than a lot of stuff. But also,
mm-hmm.
I go barefoot. Sometimes I just take off my shoes and I go running, you know, and literally barefoot. There's nothing less expensive than that. So I'm surely there are people who are attaching to this thing as a fad. But from my end and my approach, it's really about returning to what's natural. My Vibrams last me way longer than running shoes ever did, and they're less expensive, you know, and so it's a better model for me.
Now,
I'm buying running shoes anyway, you know.
I live in New York City, and I usually run on concrete. Are they okay for that?
Oh, yeah.
Because concrete isn't natural. That's my point.
Well,
so natural, there's no such thing as natural anymore.
Well, you're right, but the thing is that there are hard surfaces in nature. I mean, there's trail running that is hard-packed. And when you run in the barefoot style, you run, there's a great book called Barefoot Running, and it shows the mechanics of it, and you hit mid to front foot, and it makes the pressure not on your knee but on your calves. And we're built with a very springy step, and when you return to that kind of gait, you suffer a lot less injury, even on concrete. And there are literally... Scott Jurek is one of the best ultra marathoners in the entire world, and his shoes are minimal. They have no arch support and very little of anything. And he's been running injury free, you know, 100-mile races. So it's happening.
Wow. Okay. So, but if I want to get into this, I need to start slowly.
like anything else. And I addressed that in the book, because I didn't, and I hurt my foot because I went way too fast, way too far. And so that was part of the reason of inspiration of my book, is like, I need to apply this to myself. I need to ease my way into these things just like everybody does. And so, yeah, you start by walking barefoot. Bring back the muscles that have been unused for, you know, years and years, and just walk barefoot. Go run in your normal shoes, but during the day when you're in your room and walking around, take your shoes off. See what it's like to bend your feet again, spread your toes out, and just develop that over time. And then later, you know, run a tenth of a mile barefoot, see how that feels, or less, you know, and build up over time.
I'm barefoot all the time in my apartment, and it drives some of my neighbors crazy, because sometimes I forget to put shoes on when I have to go out into the building, the rest of the building, to do laundry or something. So I occasionally put flip-flops on, but I do prefer walking around barefoot, so I guess I have to try this running.
Yeah, do the work, and you can go on YouTube. There's like 1,000 videos on showing, you know, the proper step. And the thing is, it's not a new step, right? It's getting back to what happened before we, you know, had running shoes. We didn't evolve with running shoes, you know, back, you know, years and years and years and years and years ago. We would run in moccasins, and those have no support at all. It's a very thin little piece of leather underneath our feet that would kind of keep us from getting cut, but it was no support at all, and we managed to do just fine.
Now, you work with people to transition to a healthy diet, but I'm sure there are plenty of people that don't want to go all the way plant-based, people that you work with.
That's right.
And how does that work out? Do some of them surprise you in the end after all you've told them, or and want to eat more plant foods, or some are just really believe that it's not good for them?
I think that I get less people who believe that it's not good for them, and more people that understand that it's not good for them, but have, you know, some other concerns in terms of the taste of food and the ritual food and the tradition of food. And sometimes people just, you know, weigh it out for themselves, and they'd rather be on prescription drugs and eat their fried chicken than make a change. And I can't, you know, like, I hit a wall. I go, okay, cool, you know. But what I do, some people really surprise me, and people that you would least expect to turn around do sometimes, and they do because the better they start to feel, the better they want to feel. And so they start adding a little bit in. They go, oh, that's kind of cool. That feels really good. And all of a sudden they raise their level of overall health such that when they eat, you know, cheese, all of a sudden cheese doesn't make them feel good, when before they just kind of felt crappy all the time. They didn't know it. So I start by saying, why don't we add in a few things? And if you're going to have cheese, have a salad with it, or if you have a house salad, have a salad with anything. And then all of a sudden the bad stuff starts to make them feel crappy, and then they just don't want it anymore. And I had that exact thing happen to a client where a year after eating really well, she went to a party and her favorite cheese was on this table. And I walked up to it and I looked at it and I was going to grab one, and I didn't feel like having it.
Mm.
That means she got over the hump, and she does. It's not worth it for her. And just like it's not worth it for me, I loved cheese, but I was tired of being an asthmatic with allergies. I there was too many other things I wanted to do in my life, and so I'm not tempted by it. And that was before I even learned about the, you know, the ethical and environmental ramifications of food choices.
What do I always say here on the show? It's all about food. I always say, you don't know how good you can feel. You just don't know.
That's right.
And you can feel amazing.
Yeah, and if people don't, you know, it's like Louis C.K. is this comedian. I've been quoting him recently because he said, just recently I found out that food is supposed to make you feel good. You know, and it's because, you know, it's like he goes, I usually eat and I'm like, ugh. You know, like, we don't even know. The food that we're naturally drawn to is supposed to nourish us and give us energy. It's not supposed to make us, you know, go into a food coma and give us allergies and make us sick.
Yeah,
you
we're
know?
Such
and
a so nutty getting, bunch.
Right. We are a nutty bunch. We are.
Okay, now what about kids? You have small children.
I
and
do.
You feed them plant foods?
100%. And about 99% whole, but 100% plants.
And how do they respond to all of this? Because that's one of the big complaints parents have. They can't get their kids to eat. They can't get their kids to eat well.
What I would say is, and I make this argument in the book, as parents, is do it for yourself first. Create, you know, be that example. And one of those things is to get the food out of the house. Get the bad food out of the house. Period. What kids will do is they will transition like everybody else, and they might raise this thing for a couple days. But if you cut a bunch of vegetables and put them on the counter with a good dip and you walk away and you don't say, you got to eat this and you got to, you know, that whole thing. I'm a parent, so I'm speaking from experience here. So people are like, well, he doesn't understand. I get it. I got three kids. Okay. They will eat it. They're going to eat the food. Sure, they might miss a meal because they're going to rebel against you. It's fine. Your job as a parent is to make sure, and this is my opinion, is to make sure your kids grow up healthy and happy, and you want to provide for them what is best for them. And that means that you should be feeding them really good food. And I always say this to parents because parents don't want to draw the line with food. I go, do your kids watch TV? And they go, yeah. And I go, do you let them watch whatever they want, whenever they want, as much as they want? And they go, no, 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 of course not. We only let them watch from this time to this time and only these shows. I go, okay, so apply the same constraints to food that you put, because that's the most important thing that you're doing for your child is feeding their body so that they grow up thinking clearly and acting well and behave, you know, being calm, how much food affects that ADD and ADHD and all these kinds of things. That's a huge, you know, you can do that. Apply the same constraints to food. It's okay. You can do it in a pleasurable way, but first is living the example and saying,
like,
God, this tastes amazing.
I like that analogy with television, because most parents get the thing that they shouldn't be letting their kids watch television whenever they want.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good one.
They'll totally get that. You know, they'll get it, and they'll even get like candy. You know, they'll get that, you know, but when I say cheese is in the same realm with candy, they, you know, they just about die, you know, and I go, you know, it's not helping your child become healthy. And if you really want to feed them cheese, understand that it's a treat and minimize it as much as you would minimize lollipops, you know, and it's just that we're told that milk is a good thing for us, and it's not. It's a totally unhealthy thing for us.
Let's talk about music.
Now we're talking.
Now we're talking.
Here we go.
I have some visions and dreams of all vegan kind of musical events and putting plant-powered musicians together and making beautiful music.
I think it would be great, and I would say because we don't eat dairy, a lot less phlegm in the throat.
Absolutely.
That's where I'm coming from, a really clear throat, so it's got to be some good music.
Yeah, well, I've sung opera and musical theater, and I know all about the phlegm in the throat and the power of a dairy-free diet. Yeah, it's just common sense.
Yeah, right?
So what kind of music do you do, and where can we listen to it and find it and enjoy it? And
well, I'm the head of a band called the Sid Hillman Quartet, and we've been alive for years now. Put out a bunch of records and toured the U.S. and Canada and Europe, and it's indie rock. It's a little bit of Western, so it's like alternative rock with a little bit of Western flavor there. I got some pedal and some lap steel kind of things hinting around, but mostly it's indie rock and all original stuff, and we put out albums. They can find that at, I think they just go to SidHillmanQuartet.com or TheSHQ.com, or they can just Google Sid Hillman Quartet, or they can find us pretty fast. But we're all over iTunes and all that kind of stuff.
Great. Okay. And then can you talk, we have just a couple of minutes, can you talk about the Stanford Inn in Mendocino?
I can, because I'm going to sound like an ad campaign again, but I can't believe that I work at this place. But it's owned by Joan and Jeff Stanford. They've owned it since 1980. And they basically, from the very beginning, created a green business before, I always joke, before green was even a color, you know, and because they wanted to build it in that way. And they bought it, this little teeny building, but since have added a huge amount of things on there, two other buildings and an entire organic nursery. It's got canoeing, all this kind of stuff. Anyhow, they asked me to be the programs director for their wellness center called the Mendocino Center for Living Well. So I've been doing that. And it has everything. What we, Jeff and Joan and I all are definitely in line in our philosophies of health. And it includes art therapy and nutrition and gardening and cooking and yoga and massage and Tai Chi and a full Chinese herbal dispensary and nature tours on the big river. And, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just this incredible vibe.
I got to get there. I just
got to
get there.
It is. You've got to come up. I mean, people come to that inn just to have a vacation because, of course, it's a beautiful 41-room inn. And then they have these life-changing experiences where they go, like it happens, and they didn't even know it. And it's just this awesome
little place. Thank you for joining me. And it's all about food. I hope to meet you sometime and see you up there at the Stanford Inn. And thank you for writing Approaching the Natural.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And I just want to remind everybody, go to swinginggourmets.com. That's my latest project with responsibleeatingandliving.com. We will be premiering on Earth Day, April 22nd in San Jose, California. And if you're anywhere near San Jose, if you know the way to San Jose, please join me there on April 22nd. So you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com or swinginggourmets.com. Have a delicious week. Bye.